Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. As Hillary Clinton moves closer to becoming the first woman ever to be nominated for president by a major political party, it's worth asking, why has it taken so long for an American woman to get this close to the Oval Office? Part of the answer is that public attitudes are slow to change. An example of that came during Clinton's first run for the presidency in 2008. In the lead up to the New Hampshire primary, she was speaking in Salem when a heckler interrupted her.
Some people think you bring about change by demanding it. And some people think you bring about change by...
The heckler chanted, "Iron my shirt," and held a sign saying the same thing before he was escorted out of the room.
Oh, the remnants of sexism alive and well tonight. As I think has just been abundantly demonstrated, I am also running to break through the highest and hardest glass ceiling to our government.
That moment from 2008 is where historian Ellen Fitzpatrick begins her fascinating new book about the long quest for the American presidency by women. More than 200 have tried. Fitzpatrick profiles three of them: Victoria Woodhull in 1872, Maine Senator Margaret Chase Smith in 1964, and New York Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm in 1972. Ellen Fitzpatrick is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. Her latest book is The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency, and she's here with us in Studio 3. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you, Ellen.
Thank you.
So, we mentioned, I learned from your book, 200 women have tried. I was surprised by that number. Tell me why you focused on these three, and then we'll talk about them one at a time.
Okay. These three are among, of all these women who tried to pursue the presidency, they actually sparked a national conversation about the fitness of a woman for the chief executive office in the land. And their campaigns also coincided with kind of breakthrough moments or potential breakthrough moments in the modern women's movement. So there was a convergence of the personality, the historical moment, and also the response of the public to these figures that made them stand out.
You know, your book, I mean, for obvious reasons, and we referred to them right there at the top of the of this segment, comes at such an interesting time as we have this race for the Democratic nomination, where Hillary Clinton seems to be out in front and could be facing in the fall election Donald Trump. I mean, so this historic moment where a woman finally breaks through this glass ceiling, going up against someone who seems to stand as the antithesis almost to the to that value and that set of accomplishments in many ways.
It's not, it does seem like a paradox, but it's a paradox that stands the test of time.
Yeah.
In virtually every moment, these women candidates faced the kinds of opposition that we're seeing today, and certainly many of the attitudes that have been articulated about Hillary Clinton.
Well, I want to talk about these three fascinating women, but first I want to invite listeners in on this conversation. Listeners, why has it taken so long when other countries, from Iceland to Israel to India, to name just three countries that begin with I, have elected female leaders? Why has America been so slow? In 2016, are the remnants of sexism still alive? Are they behind us? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is historian Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's the author of The Highest Glass Ceiling: Women's Quest for the American Presidency. So let's start with Victoria Woodhull. She ran for president back in 1872. Tell us something about her story.
Well, she's a remarkable woman who had a career as initially as a spiritualist and a clairvoyant. She came from a very impoverished background. She was married off by her parents at the age of 15 to a physician who had been called in to treat her for a fever, who wound up being an opium addict, and she had a very troubled marriage to him, two children. She went on to leave him and marry a second man who was a Civil War veteran. The amazing thing about Victoria Woodhull, given the current scene, is that she, too, had very close ties to Wall Street. She was herself, with her sister, the first woman to open a brokerage firm on Wall Street. She was a Wall Street broker and had become extremely wealthy as a result and was able, like Donald Trump, to self-finance her campaign for the presidency.
Fascinating, huh? Now, this, of course, is taking place in 1872, Reconstruction. Of course, she's running for president at a time when women didn't even have the vote. So what was the sort of political energy that surrounded her, the political atmosphere that surrounded her like?
Well, the moment was really one in which the suffrage movement was trying to use the moment of Reconstruction when new constitutional amendments were being passed to confer political rights on African Americans to press their case that it was time to enfranchise women. And Victoria Woodhull had the insight to say, it's hard to rally people around a cause, but you might be able to rally them around a candidate. Why not me? I'll run for president and present myself as an exemplar of women's possibilities and as a way of staking a claim to women's equality in the political process and in the society.
And what was the kind of, how would you sort of characterize the opposition that she faced at that time?
Well, what's fascinating about Woodhull is how intrigued the public was with this idea. And they looked around at a world that was being really transformed in the aftermath of the Civil War, the emancipation of 4 million slaves, these new constitutional amendments. And people would say things, and the pundits and so forth and the press would say, well, you know, it's an unsettled age. Why not a woman president? It's possible. Maybe could she really be any worse than the Grant administration, the petticoat government that she might create? So they were quite intrigued by her, but she was brought down by a scandal in her own family.
Yeah, and we have to hear a little bit about the scandal that brought her down, because it made headlines.
It certainly made headlines. Her mother was a quite disturbed woman, and she, throughout Victoria's, tortured childhood, she had really been clearly mentally haunted. And so she, in the midst of Victoria Woodhull's presidential campaign, went to the police in New York City and reported that her daughter's husband, a man named Colonel Blood, was trying to kill her. Mm-hmm. And what the investigation into that charge revealed was that Victoria Woodhull had taken in her former husband. So she was living with her ex-husband and her current husband. Mm. Well, that was not deemed proper in Victorian America, and she became really the victim of charges that she was sexually licentious and
One of the first sort of political sex scandals of our time.
It was a big one.
Wow.
It wasn't the first one, but it was a big one.
All right.
And pretty hard to overcome your mother going to the authorities about you. She, lashed out and named one of the most revered Protestant ministers of her time, Henry Ward Beecher, as someone who was engaged in sexual activity with his one of his members of his congregation, and set off an additional sexual scandal.
So the next woman you profile in your book, we're going to jump forward almost 100 years, a Republican senator from Maine who sought the Republican nomination in 1964, running against Barry Goldwater, Margaret Chase Smith. We've got some archival tape here from 1964 talking about her announcement. Let's listen.
Perhaps the point that has impressed me the most on this argument is that women before me pioneered and smoothed the way for me to be the first woman to be elected to both the House and the Senate, and that I should give back in return that which had been given to me.
So Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith from Maine, tell us a little bit about her story and why you included her.
Oh, she was an absolutely remarkable woman, extremely powerful political figure in her own right, who actually, like Hillary Clinton, came onto the national scene through the career of her husband, who had been a representative in the United States Congress from Maine. He died in office, and he, before he died, urged his constituents to vote for his wife to fill out his term, which she did, and then she ran on her own for the House and then was the first woman elected on her own to the Senate and had a long career and a very distinguished one.
And for a long while, the only woman in the Senate, right?
Correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was it like for her to run for president in 1964 against Barry Goldwater? What did she face?
Well, she faced a kind of antediluvian sexism that really was worse than what Victoria Woodhull faced in 1872. The kinds of things said about Margaret Chase Smith were not being said about Victoria Woodhull. She was portrayed almost instantly. She went from being one of the most admired women in national politics to being portrayed as addled, not strong enough. Did she really have the stamina? This woman had served on the House Armed Services Committee, on the Senate Armed Services Committee. She was really a very accomplished and strong-willed, independent woman. But overnight, the whole depiction of her was completely turned upside down.
Hmm.
And she was also one of the strong theme in the reaction to her was that she was too old at 65 because, as one pundit put it, she was menopausal and everybody knows what women are like when they go through menopause.
Oh boy.
Could she really handle, you know, being president in the nuclear age?
So we've got some more tape from her that I want to play. In her announcement, she ran through some of the reasons she shouldn't run, mm-hmm. including this idea. Here's what she said.
There are those who make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world and that it should be kept that way, and that a woman on the national ticket of a political party would be more of a handicap than a strength.
So this idea that the strength of a candidate, you know, that's something that this has plagued female candidates, this idea that this is a man's world and women wouldn't be aren't strong enough.
That's right.
This has gone on for a while.
Well, and we're hearing it today where Mr. Trump has suggested that Hillary Clinton lacks, quote, the strength. Of course, he also said this about Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush, so it may not be evidence of sexism, but it's certainly a theme that has surfaced often.
Right. He's also said that she's only gotten as far as she's gotten because she is a woman,
right?
Which is a way of sort of completely overlooking her substance as a politician.
Yes, the remarkable thing about Hillary Clinton is the degree to which she has overcome the obstacles that stood in the way of these other women, but these are now being cast as liabilities.
Ellen Fitzpatrick, I want to talk about Shirley Chisholm, but I also want to get some callers into this conversation. We've got Osial calling from Dorchester. Osial, did I pronounce your name right, first of all?
Yes, thank you, Osial.
Osial, yeah. It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a very simple question. Do you think that, and it's the question for your expert, obviously, will a woman or a female president bring to the table the same political and mental proficiencies and experiences, sensibilities, or would they bring different ones? And what's the distinction there? Is it, are we looking for, are we thinking the presidency is this the thing that requires these set of proficiencies, or are we thinking that it's a little more flexible and a woman would bring a new sort of perspective?
That's a really interesting question. What do you think, Ellen Fitzpatrick?
It's the age-old question of equality or difference.
Yeah.
You know, can we expect women in political office to behave pretty much like men, or are they going to bring a new dimension? Hillary Clinton claims she'll bring a new dimension because she has a greater concern about women's issues, and that may very well be. I suspect, you know, she has a reasonably strong case to make in terms of her record of trying to advance these issues. So that may be the case. It does appear, however, that women in political life do, in many cases, behave much the way that men do. So the idealistic notion that, you know, women, no more wars if we advance women presidents certainly has been dashed to ruins.
Let's get one more caller in. Kate is calling from Gardner. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, happy to do it. What's on your mind?
I'm an elementary school teacher, and over the years I've taught grades 3, 4, 5, and 6, and what's so interesting to me is for younger kids, they really are very gender equal. They're forward thinking. They don't really go to these systemic levels of sexism. But even by fifth grade, the girls stop raising their hand in class. They stop saying they like math. They're very hesitant. They defer to the boys. And I'm in a school where we really do a lot to try and put all students forward and to make things very equal. And so it's interesting to me, but it's also obviously very sad that there is still so much, I think, external sexism going on. That these girls just are getting these messages to stop talking and put their hands down, and it's so hard to figure out where they're coming from, where these messages are coming from.
Kate, thanks so much for that call. So Ellen, thinking about what Kate's talking about, I mean, is that sort of part of the answer about why this has taken so long?
It may be part of the answer, but I think it's also, in a sense, reinforces the point of those who say that there's symbolic value in crossing this threshold. That is, those who say, well, it shouldn't matter at all. What difference does it make? It may matter, in fact, in the way that we will, if we do elect a woman president, whether it's Hillary Clinton or someone else, that threshold is crossed and some of those old stereotypes do get dashed in the process.
Finally, I want to leave time to talk about Shirley Chisholm, who you talk about in your book. She's the first African-American woman elected to Congress. She ran for president in 1972, 100 years after Woodhull. Her slogan was "Unbought and Unbossed." Here's Shirley Chisholm in January of 1972.
I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am Black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am the candidate of the people of America.
Shirley Chisholm there in 1972. So Ellen Fitzpatrick, tell us a little bit about her.
She was an absolutely extraordinary person who rose up through, and what I find most remarkable about her is that she was part of an insurgency that rose up through the Irish-dominated Democratic political machine in Brooklyn. And she sort of learned at the feet of these guys and became part of a movement that eventually overthrew them in Bedford-Stuyvesant and came into the New York Assembly this way and really went on from there in a very progressive way to try to advance not only her own political career, but really the fortunes of the most disadvantaged people in American society, and was extraordinarily articulate and really quite effective in her efforts.
And what kind of opposition did she face when she declared that she was running for president?
Well, the thing that's somewhat unnerving about her was way back in Victoria Woodhull's time, one pundit said, you know, if she runs for office, all women are going to vote for her and support her. We might have a little revolution here.
Well, God forbid.
It turns out it didn't work out that way. And in Shirley's case, people like Bella Abzug, who insisted on standing on the dais with her when she announced her bid for presidency, would not endorse her. And so she faced opposition not only from those who opposed her politics, but from other feminists who felt she couldn't be elected, from some African-American male activists who felt that it wasn't a good idea to have a woman be the first standard bearer for the Democratic Party, who was African-American. So she was quite chagrined to face this opposition within people that she considered part of her own, you know, political community.
Now, do I have my history right? She was succeeded in Congress by Geraldine Ferraro, right? Do I have that right?
I don't know. Is that true?
I don't want to say I think it's true, but now I'm worried that I said that maybe we can get someone in the control room to check that.
It appears that
fact.
Neither of us are expert enough to.
If it were the case, I wanted to say that is sort of historically significant that the first Black woman in Congress was succeeded by the first woman who ran as for vice president. But we're going to check that fact right now. We're on this.
What's amazing about
it is true, I am told, by my crack fact checkers.
Very good. Okay. Well, I stand corrected as well. What's amazing about her was that she became the victim of a dirty trick from the Nixon administration late in her presidential campaign. She was hardly a threat to Richard Nixon. However, the efforts that her enemies went to really dislodge her as a presence in the political scene were extreme.
So I'm going to just wrap up with one final question. We sort of raised this right at the beginning. So as we mentioned, lots of countries around the world right now have female leaders. Germany, Chile, Brazil, South Korea, Liberia, the list goes on and on. Is there something distinct about the American system that makes it so much harder?
Well, one thing about the American system is that the chief executive is also the commander-in-chief of the military. And there had long been a sense before women were really serving in the armed services that they lacked the important military expertise. Even though not all presidents had military service, many of them did. So that seemed disqualifying on the face of it. Women also historically had been women in public life had been strongly associated with the peace movement, and that was a negative from the point of view of the public as well. In some of the other countries that we compare ourselves to on this point, it's a parliamentary system. You're voting for the party, mm-hmm. not necessarily the candidate per se, mm-hmm. in the way that we are focused so much on the individual here in the United States. For instance, Thatcher versus the Conservative Party. And then we have these sort of hereditarian claims like the Gandhi family.
Sure. Well, Ellen Fitzpatrick, you've tapped into a fascinating vein in American history. Thanks for coming in. I really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Anthony.
That's Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. Her latest book is The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. And she'll be talking about her book in Newton on Friday. You can find more information about that at radioboston.org. Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.